All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show.
Because one thing I've learned is this, in politics and in combat, cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And if you're willing to be the first person over those ramparts, you will be shocked at how many people will come with you. I'm asking you to come with me. I'm asking you to be a part of the generation that will restore the promise of this country and breathe new life into it.
Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and I want to welcome you back to Making the Argument. Today, we're going to be talking about the economy and jobs, and this is almost somewhat of a two-part series. This one, we're going to focus specifically on defining our terms around economic development, job development. What do we mean by that? What's the government's proper role? All of those things, because when we go into next week's podcast about taxes and regulation, then we're going to start to really dive into some of the policy positions that I take, the ones that I would like to advocate for in Washington, D.C. But as I've said multiple times throughout this podcast, I think it's so important to define your terms before you get into some of these policy discussions. And when we're talking about something like the economy, what I've certainly found is in political discourse, you talk about the economy, you talk about jobs, you talk about policy, and people oftentimes hear two different things based off of their perspective. And so I want to share what my perspective is. What is the approach that I'm taking, and why am I using that particular approach? So I think the first thing we have to do is talk about what do we mean when we talk about the economy. A lot of times in politics, the economy gets referred to as like an engine, or it's almost referred to as like a machine, or is it bulls and bears? You know, what exactly is it? The economy at the end of the day is us. That's what it is. It's people engaging in exchange. And there's a lot of different economic systems that you can set up. And the one that we've largely had in the United States has been more of a free market economic system. And when we look at the political discourse that we have, the debate that we're having about the sort of economic system that we should have, you see a lot of people on the left, whether it's Bernie Sanders, whether it's Elizabeth Warren to some degree, certainly here in Virginia, we have various delegates that prefer a more socialist system. Now, when we talk about the difference between a socialist system and a free market system, what exactly are we talking about? So in socialism, the real definition of it is the public ownership of the means of production and distribution. You could also describe it as the abolition of the private ownership of the means of production and distribution. The other thing that's a key component of that is, okay, now that we understand that the government, or they might argue the people, are in charge of all of the industry, all of the major plants, all the major manufacturing, technological development, that would now be in the hand of government-run institutions or organizations, right? So your private sector businesses, as we currently understood it, really wouldn't exist. It doesn't mean you wouldn't have maybe like the small mom-and-pop shop on the side of the road. It doesn't mean that, you know, you no longer own your toothbrush. It just means that like every major industry, shipping yard, telecommunications company, clothes manufacturer, grocery store, that would all be government run. That's socialism. Now, Bernie Sanders, whenever we point this out to the left or to socialists or so-claimed socialists in the Democratic Party, they usually, well, no, that's not the socialism we want. We don't want that sort of like communist government run system. No, we want Swedish socialism. The problem with that is Sweden's not socialist. Sweden is still considered a free market economy. It has a lot of socialist programs, or it has a lot of social programs, a lot of government-run programs, but that doesn't mean it's socialist in the sense that they've abolished the private ownership of the means of production. And so you almost see this little sidestep that they take. And when you really boil down to what it is that they're looking for, it actually bears a far closer resemblance to what we see in fascist economies. So if you look at what you saw in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy and fascist Spain, you didn't see a complete government takeover of all the industries, even though there was a lot of government takeover of those industries. What you saw was kind of this mixed approach where you saw fascist leaders coming out and saying that, well, we're not saying we're going to nationalize the whole economy. We're going to nationalize certain portions of the economy that they deemed were critical. And then they would say that we'll allow certain sectors of the economy to be free as long as they are falling in line with what our national objectives are or what the people's will is. And of course, it was the political elite that got to decide what the people's will actually meant. So you saw a lot of socialist leanings within fascist-style economies, but they would still allow some private sector development, provided that those private sector companies were doing what the government told them to do. And if those private sector companies, you know, didn't make government quotas or didn't prioritize manufacturing the way they wanted, then they potentially risked being taken over and nationalized, right? So again, when I say a fascist-style economic system, I don't mean to imply that every Democrat that wants more government control over the economy is a fascist in the sense that we think about it with Nazi Germany. That's not the argument we're making. We're simply saying that a lot of those economic policies that those types of states and largely authoritarian states adopted did have a lot more emphasis on government intervention into the economy, into production, manufacturing, distribution. And that's the part where I think a lot of us on the free market side get very, very, you know, worried about those sorts of that sort of rhetoric or that sort of objective. It's not because we don't all want people to have access to food or healthcare or education. We all want those things. It's really a debate about what is the best mechanism to do so. So understand that on the free market side, we put a lot of emphasis on the private ownership of the means of production and distribution, right? So we think it's perfectly acceptable. We actually think it's a good thing for people to be able to start up companies, produce products, to work in voluntary cooperation with other people within the economy in order to get us the goods and services that we all want to make our lives better. And we tend to believe that the private sector does a much better job in producing those goods and services in an effective and an efficient way. Now, doesn't mean that it's always done in an effective or efficient way. Doesn't mean that every company is a roaring success or that every businessman or woman does a great job or takes care of their employees. We recognize that there are, no matter what economic system you choose, there's going to be some faults because we as human beings are not perfect. The question is which economic system not only does the best job, but creates the best incentives with respect to human nature. So we know as people, we're all interested in being able to take care of ourselves, take care of our families, people that we love, take care of our community, maybe our country. And then there's going to be other people that maybe are not as motivated by certain altruistic motives. All right. But ultimately, we know that everybody cares about taking care of themselves, their families, again, people that they love. So which system does a better job of doing that? Well, your more socialist or your centrally planned systems, right, where the government is essentially playing the command and control role within the economy, have operated based off of this idea of from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. And they say this, and when we first hear it on a superficial level, it seems to make a lot of sense, right? Well, yeah, if someone's got an ability, then that's the thing that they should work in. And if somebody's got a need, of course, we want to meet that need. The problem is that when it's the government deciding what your ability is and deciding what your needs are, right, and you don't have a way to escape the government control that they've put you under, you're constantly in a situation where you have an incentive to push and advocate for your needs, right? But there's a disincentive with respect to what you can do through your abilities because you don't get the benefit of your labor. Right? The government decides who gets the benefit of your labor. You don't get it. And so ultimately, the government is really controlling you. And that's one of the biggest problems that we have from a free market perspective with socialism or fascist economic policies, that ultimately politicians are now in the driver's seat, not just of the economy, they're in the driver's seat of you. They're the ones deciding what it is that you can do, what it is that you can't do. They're the ones that are setting a cap on, you know, how much economic success you can actually achieve within your lifetime. And that doesn't mean that you can't achieve a lot of economic success or wealth within a socialist or a fascist system. It's just that it tends to be the people that have political power that achieve it at the expense of everybody else. So you're no longer gaining wealth by doing a good job of providing products and services to your fellow citizens. You're now gaining wealth by how close are you to the politicians in power. And we see this through centralized systems no matter where we go across the country, regardless of the culture, regardless of the time, regardless of the resources available within a particular country. If the government starts to adopt more central planning, more economic controls, then the people that benefit are not the poorest. The people that benefit are those that have the best lobbyists, those who have the best connections to the government power, which is making these economic decisions. Again, in a free market system, we like the idea of individual consumers, producers working together in voluntary cooperation, and then prices get to play that coordinating function within the economy to decide where should resources go. And a perfect example of this actually came from someone named Leonard Reed, and he wrote a book called iPencil. And this whole pamphlet that he wrote is essentially a pencil describing itself and saying that, you know, no one person across the world, you know, makes a pencil. That in reality, when you look at the graphite that's used, as the, we call it lead, but it's actually graphite. When you look at the wood that's used, when you look at the little metal band, when you look at the eraser, when you look at the paint, all of those things relied on a number of industries. So you had to have one industry that was producing the paint. For the lumber industry, it's not just about the lumber, it's about the metal and the minerals that went in used to creating the different resources we use to get the lumber in the first place. Same thing with the mining of the graphite. Same thing with the transportation mechanisms that were used in order to get those pencils from the factory to the marketplace. And one of the most fascinating things to understand about how prices work and able to, you know, play that coordinating function on how different industries work together in order to produce a product is that the primary feature of a free enterprise system or a capitalist system is not competition. The primary feature of capitalism is actually cooperation. Yes, competition takes place and competition is a good thing, but cooperation is what really makes free market systems work so far, you know, more superior to centrally planned socialist or fascist systems. And in that sense, they not only produce better economic results, they actually produce better social results, better results with respect to justice. Because now, if you have the ability to decide how your labor will be used within the marketplace and in cooperation with others, if you have the ability to determine what fields and interests you want to work in order to produce something, you can do that. And you have the ability to find out at what sectors in the economy is your labor in the most demand so that you can get paid the most in order to do it. And you have control over yourself, not some government agency, not some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. And so in that sense, it not only produces better economic results, since you're going to work harder when you have the ability to do something that you actually want to do, but it produces, again, those better social results as well. Now, let's talk about some of the things that kind of creep into the economic discussion. One of the things that you'll notice about free market economies is that they tend to produce, again, not only better economic results, but better results with respect to social, what's commonly referred to as social justice. So when we talk about equality before the law, when we talk about equity of opportunity, right? Does everyone have a chance to be able to go into the marketplace and move up the economic ladder regardless of their starting point or regardless of, you know, what their political connections might be? There is a study that's conducted every year called the Index of Economic Freedom. And what this study does is it looks at different levels of economic freedom on the regulatory side, the tax side, the fiscal side, you know, property rights side. And they rank all of the countries. And what's so fascinating about this is here's what you end up discovering when you look at this Index of Economic Freedom. The countries on the top 20 are not just the freest economically. They're not just the wealthiest. They've actually got some of the best records with respect to civil liberties, private property rights, the ability for people to start off at the bottom of the economic ladder and move all the way up to the top of it. And you see this evidenced in things like in the United States, it's something like over 70% of millionaires in the United States are first generation. That means they didn't inherit their wealth. They actually created something new, or they created a new service or an industry or a product, and allowed them to become wealthy, not because they have the best political connections, but because people chose to do business with them. And you see this across the board in the Index of Economic Freedom. By contrast, if you go down to the lower rung, if you go down to the bottom 20% of those countries, here's what you find. You find a lot of economic controls. You find a lot of the government taking over various industries, whether it's airlines or the banking industry or mining or, you know, anything significant within manufacturing. That's what you end up seeing. Everything from the really hardcore command and control economies of North Korea to the more relaxed command and control economies of places like China. But the results tend to be the same, right? The more freer the economy becomes, the more better off people are across the board. The more restrictive the economy becomes, poorer people suffer, but the people at the top of the political pyramid, they're doing fabulously well. So what's important to understand about socialist and fascist economies is that they don't just produce bad economic results. I've sometimes heard socialists saying that, well, maybe we don't produce as much as capitalism, but at least there's greater equity. Okay, yeah, there's greater equality of suffering among everybody within socialist or fascist economies because the government's the one deciding who gets what, right? But is that really what we want here in the United States? Do we want a freer economy, not just because of the economic benefits, but because ultimately it recognizes the inherent value of each individual to chart out their life to include their economic life? Or do we want a system where your ability to succeed in the economy is not tied to your creativity or your work ethic? No, it's tied to your political connections. And the more control we give the government over deciding what the economy looks like, the more control we give to the government in deciding winners and losers in the economy, the more you're going to have a system where your success is tied not to your ability, it's tied to your lobbyist. And that's not what we want. And I see a lot of my Democrat colleagues fall into this trap of thinking that if they just pass the right law, it'll make it better for everyone. And I want to go over a couple examples of this because obviously in the United States, we don't have a full command and control despotic system where we control the entire economy. But there are a lot of ways that the government does intervene into the economy that I think actually hurts people, even though the Democrat politicians, which put these forward to include Abigail Spanberger, swear that it's going to make things better. So let's go over a couple of different examples of this. One of it has to do with, again, the whole act of nationalizing industries. So we've actually seen Democrats, I saw Maxine Waters suggest that if oil companies didn't operate the way she wanted, she would advocate nationalization of those oil companies. And the problem is that we've seen other countries where they nationalize a particular industry. It doesn't lead to greater equity or greater sustainability for everyone. It once again just leads to those politicians most connected to it, essentially either running the industry very, very poorly, or running it in a way where there's a lot of fraud, waste, abuse, and corruption, right? Because when you nationalize a particular industry, you are actually taking out the competitive and the cooperative model that naturally exists within the free market, and now it's politicians deciding what an industry should produce based off of political incentives as opposed to what is the best plan for running this particular industry in order to serve customers. Right? The customers in a nationalized industry are no longer the population in general. The customers are the government because it's the politicians deciding what sort of funds are allocated and what sort of services or products are created. So if that is one of the major problems that we see, and we see Democrats now advocating for more nationalization of industry. And it really is something that should concern us because it produces very, very bad results, not just for the industry, but for the people that work in the industry, and especially for the customers that depend on these industries for the various things that we need, from food to gas to transportation, communication, whatever it is. The free market produces better results. Another example that has gotten a lot of attention over the last several years has been minimum wages, and specifically raising the minimum wage. And I want to draw a real careful example here. I think a lot of people, when they hear the minimum wage, they think to themselves, well, this is going to help poor people because, you know, they're trying to raise a family on the minimum wage and it's really hard to do and you've got to work multiple jobs. I hear a lot of Democrats saying that working one job should be enough to raise a family. Here's what I find interesting about that. Who are they to say what any one job should do or should not do? I mean, obviously, if you're working as a barista at a coffee shop, you're probably not making enough money to be able to raise a family of four. And when a Democrat says, well, if you can't get by and raise your family on one job, well, then that job shouldn't exist. All right, so what are they advocating? That there shouldn't be any baristas at a coffee shop? Or are they saying that we should drastically raise the cost of what it is to actually hire a barista, which means you're going to have increased costs in coffee, increased costs in products, increased costs in services? One of my biggest problems with the minimum wage and the way Democrats talk about it is they always assume that it's going to react according to their intentions as opposed to actual economic realities. I really came face to face with this in the last General Assembly session where I had a room, I had a group of students come to me and they were asking me what sort of bills before the legislature would affect the agriculture industry this year. And I talked about some of the bills that were specifically directed at agriculture. And then I said, but actually the biggest one that will affect you has to do with the minimum wage. And so I asked these students, I said, here's my first question. Do you like the minimum wage? Do you think the minimum wage is a good idea? Or do you think increasing the minimum wage is a good idea? And almost every student raised their hand. And then I said, okay, here's my second question. How many people within the labor market, right, the people that are out there looking for jobs or that have jobs, how many of those people, what percentage of the economy do you think works for minimum wage? First student raised her hand and she said 70%. Another student thought it was 60%. And I looked and I said, well, actually, according to statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it's under 3% of the actual labor force is making minimum wage. This shocked these students because these students have grown up believing that there were just, you know, millions of people, the tens of millions of people trying to raise families on minimum wage jobs. They had no idea that such a small percentage of the population actually worked on minimum wage. Then I asked them this question. I said, of all the people on minimum wage, what do you think the average age is? And now they started to kind of get in. We started to go through this critical thinking process. I said, well, it's probably younger people. I said, you're actually right. Why do you think it's younger people? And they said, well, because they have less experience, they have less skills, and so they're probably going to be the ones to do the jobs that require lower skills. I said, okay, perfect. I said, now here's my next question. Of all the people on minimum wage this year, how many of them do you think will be on minimum wage next year if they continue to work? Because the bottom line is that it's an incredibly small percentage. Almost none of the people making minimum wage this year will be continuing to make minimum wage next year if they're staying in the same industry and they're holding down a job. That's because the economy is fluid. People are moving between different income brackets. One of the biggest problems with minimum wages is that it treats the price of labor as if it's arbitrary, as if government can just pass a law and make everyone richer. If you really believe that's true, then why would you stop at a $15 minimum wage? Make it a $100 minimum wage if you think that's how the economy works. But in reality, what we see whenever the government tries to interfere with price fixing, and this is a form of price fixing, younger people, people with less skill sets, who desperately need that first job in order to build up their experience, can't get a job in the first place because now they've been priced out of the labor market. The other thing that we end up seeing is prices rise for those goods and services that people really need, whether it's food, whether it's clothing. The prices go up because now the government has forced people to pay more. So people lose jobs. People can't find a job, prices go up for products and services that we all need, all because the government pretended that they could try to centrally plan the price of labor within the economy. And there's a lot of other examples that we can use where here in the United States, politicians have intervened into the economy either to the benefit of a particular industry at the expense of everyone else, or they have intervened in a way thinking that they were going to achieve positive results for someone that was poor, for someone that needed an opportunity, when the reality was is they manipulated the market in such a way as to actually put the very people they thought to help at a disadvantage against others within the economy. So when we go over taxes and regulations next week, there's a couple things that I want us all to think about. One is, from an economic perspective, have socialist and centrally planned economies or fascist economies, have they done a better job economically than free market economies? So the economies that are more free. Obviously, there's always some restrictions, always taxation, things like that, right? But do freer economies produce better economic results than centrally planned or socialist economies? And I think you'll find that the answer is overwhelmingly yes. You would much rather be a poor person in a freer country than you would in a centrally planned socialist or fascist economic system, right? The second question I want us to consider is not just from the economic standpoint, not just from the standpoint of having access to goods and services or being able to do the sort of job you want, but I also want us to look at it from the perspective of which systems tend to produce more equity with respect to civil liberties. Right? Do centrally planned fascist or socialist systems, do they treat people better with respect to equal justice before the law? Or do free societies do a better job of doing that? Because one of the things that you'll find is linked is that as people are able to get more wealthy, as they are able to have more control over their own lives, they tend to demand more freedoms from their government. They tend to demand more justice within society. And that can be a very positive thing. And so I want us to look at it from both the economic side as well as the justice side. The other thing I would like us to do, or I would like to encourage you to do, is I have some recommended reading and some recommended resources to take a look at. So if you've never really picked up a book on economics, and I promise you, I'm not going to try to bore you with some long dissertation on this, but if you've always kind of wondered, you know, how does the economy really work, right? I know what politicians say, but almost no politician is an economist. You know, not enough politicians have any real practical experience in running a business or providing products and services to people. So what really is the economy? Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell. It's not a long book. Thomas Sowell actually prides himself. He is a Harvard Chicago School trained economist. He has taught at several universities, to include at Stanford. He's brilliant. And he writes about economics in a way that is designed for the layman. It's designed for someone like me to be able to pick up basic economics and really start to understand things like, how do prices really work? How does trade work? How does competition and cooperation within the marketplace work? How does government regulation and taxes affect what companies produce and what they don't produce? How does it affect our job markets? Thomas Sowell in Basic Economics does a fabulous job of explaining this. I would highly recommend you read it. The other book on economics that I would highly recommend is Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. This book is actually relatively short. It's not a difficult read at all, but he also does a very good job of explaining how the economy really works as opposed to how politicians often think it should work. So Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell and Economics in One Lesson by Hazlitt are two great books. If you don't have time to do a lot of reading, which I certainly understand, there's some really good information out there too that you can get through podcasts. One of my favorite YouTube channels is the Hoover Institute's Uncommon Knowledge. So let's say you don't have a whole lot of time to read these books, but you wouldn't mind watching listening to a 30 or 45 minute interview. Go on Uncommon Knowledge and look for Thomas Sowell, because he talks about basic economics. He talks about economic facts and fallacies. He talks about a whole litany of issues that are really, I think, enjoyable to listen to. Thomas Sowell is brilliant. He's also kind of a smart aleck, and so I think it makes him fun and entertaining to listen to. But just check some of those out before we go into the next podcast, because while we don't have the time right now to go over a complete, exhaustible list of all the different economic principles, we did want to lay out some basic guidelines between, you know, more centrally planned socialist and fascist economies versus more free market economies. We wanted to make the case for both the economic realities as well as the realities around civil liberties and justice. And then we also wanted to show how there's subtle ways that the government interferes into more free market economies in order to push them more towards centrally planned ones. So please, please, please check out those resources before you watch the next podcast. I think it's going to provide a lot of insight. Another program that you might want to watch, it's a little bit longer, but you can watch it in increments, is Free to Choose by Milton Friedman. Thomas Sowell is actually one of the featured people in that series. But again, another great YouTube series, another great podcast series that you can listen to. So once again, thank you for joining us. This has been Nick Freitas with Making the Argument, talking about the concept of the economy and jobs, how they're created, how they're destroyed. Next week, we're going to talk specifically about taxes and regulations, because when we talk about government policy interacting with the economy, it almost always comes in the form of a tax or a regulation. So If we want a freer economy, which is going to allow people to not only attain more wealth, but really pursue happiness in accordance with their definition of it, not the government's, then we need to talk about what taxes can actually foster a good economic environment versus which taxes are absolutely destructive and serve no real positive purpose. We need to talk about regulations. Which regulations can potentially be helpful with respect to protecting property rights and things of that nature versus which regulations are purely put there to the benefit of those people that have political connections at the expense of those who do not. So tune in next week. We're going to go ahead and wrap up this two-part series on the economy, jobs, taxes, and regulations. We're going to lay out those specific policy positions so you know exactly where I stand, and we'll lay out the positive benefits that we think a tax lowering taxes and tax reform combined with lowering regulations and regulatory reform would have, not just on the economy, but for all of us who interact in the economy on a daily basis and want to be able to live our lives and do pursue happiness the way we want. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.